found serious discrepancies between the medical records and what the PIs had entered on their CRFs. The rules of the trials clearly stated that the PIs must record all adverse reactions on their CRFs and report immediately to the FDA. The Boston PIs did neither. The FDA documents showed that the PIs knew very well which patients were on AZT and which on placebo, that they were skewing safety results in AZT's favor to give advantage to the AZT participants. Researchers began by placing the sickest patients in the placebo group. The researchers then bent over backward to coddle the group that took AZT, giving them more supportive medical services than the placebo subjects. For example, individuals taking AZT during the 4-month study received 6 times more blood transfusions than the placebo group. Of those who got AZT, all suffered from its unspeakable toxicity. A number of them would very definitely have died from anemia had the PIs not given the blood transfusions to keep them alive, says Lauritsen. AZT causes anemia in every animal species ever studied, including human beings. In his book, Poisoned by Prescription, Lauritsen explains how patients taking AZT became anemic and suffered low white blood cell counts accompanied by vomiting. FDA's documents showed that everyone in the AZT group suffered severe toxicities and anemia, yet NIAID's official report listed no adverse effects among AZT recipients. Some of the AZT patients suffered adverse reactions so deadly that they needed multiple blood transfusions just to keep them alive. Dr. Fauci's crooked researchers pumped these individuals with regular blood transfusions and then neglected to record their multiplicity of health problems. In the AZT group, 30 patients, over half the total, clung to life until the end of the study, only with help from multiple blood transfusions. In each case, the Boston PIs checked no adverse reactions on the CRFs. Some 20% received multiple transfusions. In the placebo group, on the other hand, only 5 patients received transfusions. "What happens when you get a blood transfusion?" asks noted AIDS researcher and author Dr. Robert E. Wilner, MD, PhD. "You look better, you feel better, and you live a little bit longer." But the most important question and lesson from all of this, you must ask the question, why do those on AZT need 6 times more transfusions in a 4-month period than the individuals on the placebo? Because you're dealing with a killer drug. Many of the patients would have died from the toxicities of AZT if they had not been given emergency blood transfusions, reports Lauritsen. This is a serious adverse effect. That means literally that they would have died from the poison. And yet the case report forms that showed up eventually would report no adverse effects. I mean, this is a type of dishonesty. It's hard to go any further than that. Dr. Wilner, who died in 1995, accused Dr. Fauci of using transfusions and other artifices to systematically conceal AZT's horrendous toxicity. What do we have to say about the National Institutes of Health? When a private independent laboratory found AZT to be 1,000 times more toxic than the laboratory of the NIH, we can understand a 5% error in a laboratory, even a 10% error, but a 10,000% error or a 100,000% error, that's fraud. One typically appalling item in Spitzig's report concerned patient 1009, who was already taking AZT and was therefore ineligible to participate in the clinical trial. The Boston PIs nevertheless illegally entered him in the study and assigned him to the placebo group, although he never stopped taking AZT. He suffered typical AZT toxicities, including severe headaches and anemia, dropped out of the study after less than a month, and died 2 months later. The PIs counted him as a death in the placebo group. Lauritsen wrote, Further comment would be superfluous. If this is not fraud, the word has no meaning. Even in that innocent era, the United States mainstream media heavily censored journalistic criticism of Dr. Fauci and the corruption in the AZT studies. Most Americans were therefore unaware of any dissent from the AIDS orthodoxy. This was less true in Europe and the UK. On February 12, 1992, Channel 4 television in London broadcast a documentary, AZT, Cause for Concern. Produced by Meditel, the film described the material from the FOIA documents, exposed the crooked AZT trials as rank fraud, and chronicled the terrible toxicities of the drug. The next day, the charity Wellcome Foundation divested itself of most of its stock in Wellcome Pharmaceuticals, the parent company of Burroughs Wellcome, the manufacturer of AZT. Burroughs Wellcome stocks plunged, and the company suffered a series of hostile takeovers by SmithKline Beecham and then by Glaxo. Millions around the world viewed the UK documentary, but neither it nor any of the medical AIDS critical documentaries have ever been broadcast in the U.S. AZT is the most toxic drug ever approved for long-term use. Molecular biologist Professor Peter Duisberg has explained AZT's mechanism of action. It is a random terminator of DNA synthesis, the life process itself. Dr. Joseph Sonneben stated simply, AZT is incompatible with life. On January 27, 1988, NBC News broke the censorship blockade to broadcast the first of reporter Perry Peltz's three-part expose on the AZT Fischel trial. Peltz reported additional evidence of widespread tampering with the rules and the pervasive cheating, which she discovered had started on day one. Peltz learned that Fauci's claim that the study was double-blind was a wholesale canard and reported that most volunteers knew who was on the drug and who wasn't. Since everyone was desperate for the miracle drug, the volunteers on AZT admitted to sharing their drug with placebo group members. This practice assured that researchers would get no clean results from either cohort. Furthermore, Peltz learned both placebo and study subjects were taking other drug regimens they obtained by purchasing remedies from buyers clubs. Peltz was practicing understatement when she branded NIAID's AZT experiments as seriously flawed. Dr. Fauci loves the media spotlight, but only when the pitcher is throwing softballs. Peltz closed her report with a pointed comment. When preparing this report, we repeatedly tried to interview Dr. Anthony Fauci at the National Institutes of Health. But both Dr. Fauci and Food and Drug Administration Commissioner Frank Young declined our request for interviews. When Lauritsen saw the NBC broadcast, he commented, "Welcome to the club, Perry." Fauci also refused to speak to the BBC, Canadian Broadcasting Corporation Radio, Channel 4 Television London, Italian Television, The New Scientist, and Jack Anderson. All these outlets had expressed skepticism about the official report. Of course, Dr. Fauci remained a constant presence on the more obeisant media outlets. Despite years of ineptitude and catastrophe, he has managed to survive by cultivating credulous journalists who do not ask critical questions and give him free rein to broadcast self-serving propaganda. Furthermore, he had already become a master at persuading media outlets against giving platforms to his critics, a technique that served him well in 2020 and 2021. By September of 2021, Dr. Fauci's power to muzzle his critics had achieved a mastery over free expression unprecedented in human history. That month, with a single phrase, Dr. Fauci silenced pop icon Nicki Minaj after she questioned whether COVID vaccines might be causing problems involving testicular swelling. When CNN's Jake Tapper asked him about Minaj's claim, Dr. Fauci simply declared, "The answer to that, Jake, is a resounding no." As usual, he cited no study to support this assertion. The vaccine manufacturers acknowledge that the products are not tested for effects on fertility. Nevertheless, based upon Dr. Fauci's word alone, Twitter immediately evicted Minaj from its platform, censoring her communication with her 22 million followers. Pharma's obedient attack dogs, CNN, CBS, and NBC, rushed on to the dog pile to defame and discredit the rapper and to assure the public that Minaj was wrong. Dr. Fauci, after all, had spoken. On February 19, 1988, Dr. Fauci appeared with hosts Charles Gibson and Joan London on ABC's flagship television program, Good Morning America. His appearance was part of a propaganda blitz of the friendly media platforms to resurrect himself and AZT from the all-out assault by scientists and independent reporters like Lauritsen and Peltz. Initially, GMA invited Dr. Fauci's most vocal and credible nemesis, perhaps the world's leading virologist, Berkeley professor Dr. Peter Duisberg, to appear on its show. Duisberg, who had at that date received more NIH grants than any other scientist, was enraging his benefactor agency by claiming that AZT was not just worthless, it was killing more people than AIDS. Duisberg had flown across the country to appear. On the evening before his scheduled appearance, GMA's producer called Dr. Duisberg in his Manhattan hotel room to inform him that the show had been canceled. The following morning, Duisberg awoke to watch Dr. Fauci promoting AZT and defending his study on GMA unchallenged. This was, by then, a common motif for Dr. Fauci, his gift at strong-arming obsequious, slavish, credulous reporters to silence critics and to shield him from debate. The fawning GMA hosts asked Dr. Fauci why only one drug, AZT, had been made available. He replied, "The reason why only one drug has been made available, AZT, is because it's the only drug that has been shown in scientifically controlled trials to be safe and effective." The sycophantic GMA team, characteristically, accepted Dr. Fauci's statement as gospel. Almost all of Dr. Fauci's claims in that broadcast were lies. Lauritsen points out that this brief statement contains several outstanding falsehoods. First, there have been no scientifically controlled trials of AZT. To refer to the FDA-conducted AZT trials as scientifically controlled is equivalent to referring to garbage as la haute cuisine. Second, AZT is not safe. It is a highly toxic drug. The FDA analyst who reviewed the toxicology data on AZT recommended that it should not be approved. Third, AZT is not known objectively to be effective for anything, except perhaps for destroying bone marrow. Only 33 years later did Dr. Fauci finally concede that AZT's performance in his ballyhooed clinical trials, ostensibly saving lives at a 19-to-1 ratio, was actually less than stellar. Ironically, his delayed confession arrived just as Dr. Fauci was minting a new whopper. In May 2020, during the White House meeting where he pronounced the miraculous efficacy of Gilead's antiviral remdesivir, another beneficiary of Dr. Fauci's manipulations, he admitted, "The first randomized placebo-controlled trial with AZT turned out to give an effect that was modest." That's not what he said at the time. In 1987, he claimed that AZT was 95% effective. 19 had died in the placebo group and only one in the AZT group. In 2020, based on equally flimsy and contrived evidence, he made similar claims for his lethal remedy, remdesivir, and his dubious Moderna vaccine. The media's reportage of AZT in the late 1980s almost universally lamented the cruelty of AZT's astronomical costs that ranged from $8,000 to $12,000, not counting the cost of the required blood transfusions when patients' platelets plummeted. Anthony Fauci solved this problem by making AZT standard of care for otherwise healthy people with no AIDS symptoms who nevertheless were diagnosed with HIV via PCR tests. In 1989, when Dr. Fauci recommended universal testing, the LA Times dutifully gushed that AZT could benefit about 600,000 of the estimated 1.5 million HIV-positive people in the country. Dr. Fauci promised these healthy Americans that taking AZT could delay their inevitable death sentences and would have the broadest impact of any of the therapeutic advances shown in recent years to prolong the lives of patients with AIDS or HIV infection. The New York Times' Philip J. Hiltz uncritically reported that everyone should now get tested. Dr. Fauci, the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, said that now people who are at risk for AIDS, even if they have absolutely no symptoms, it behooves them to get themselves tested. The resultant flood of additional customers clamoring for the drug significantly expanded the AZT market, allowing Burroughs Wellcome, now GlaxoSmithKline, to lower per-unit costs. No mainstream media outlet told the public about the behind-closed-doors meetings where FDA greenlighted Dr. Fauci's sketchy new initiative. The meeting's transcripts reveal the deep anxieties of the FDA panelists, who worried that they had no idea if AZT might actually help healthy people, or whether it may perhaps kill them. Among all the American journalists covering the AIDS beat, only Celia Farber showed curiosity about the particulars of this milestone debate. In 1989, she quoted from the FDA transcript in an article titled Sins of Omission in Spin. Everybody was worried about this one. To approve AZT, said Ellen Cooper, an FDA director, would represent a significant and potentially dangerous departure from our normal toxicology requirements. One doctor on the panel, Calvin Kunin, summed up their dilemma. On the one hand, he said, to deny a drug which decreases mortality in a population such as this would be inappropriate. On the other hand, to use this drug widely for areas where efficacy has not been demonstrated with a potentially toxic agent might be disastrous. We do not know what will happen a year from now, said panel chairman Dr. Itzhak Brook. The data is just too premature, and the statistics are not really well done. The drug could actually be detrimental. A little later, he said he was also struck by the facts that AZT does not stop deaths. Even those who were switched to AZT still kept dying. I agree with you, answered another panel member. There are so many unknowns. Once the drug is approved, there is no telling how it could be abused. There's no going back. By invoking the people are dying argument to rush through AZT's licensing for healthy Americans, the FDA's drug approval process was decimated. Farber told me, the idea that complying with the normal safeguards of the regulatory process and taking time to prudently study a drug for safety or efficacy was artfully conflated with murder. In that sense, an unbroken devolution of FDA's regulatory function leads from AZT to the fraud-fueled emergency use approvals of remdesivir and the Moderna mRNA vaccine during the COVID pandemic. The death blow to FDA's safety function was AZT, says Farber. After that, any potentially deadly disease became an excuse for curtailing clinical trials. Death by medication was normalized as an inherent part of progress. All those poisoned Americans were just unfortunate casualties in Little Napoleon's noble war against the germs. Dr. Fauci's fraud persuaded hundreds of thousands of people to take AZT. For many of them, it was a lethal choice. In 1987, AZT became the AIDS therapy, even though in the recommended dosage of 1,500 milligrams a day, it was absolutely fatal. Throughout the 1980s, the average lifespan of a patient on AZT was 4 years. The life expectancy only began to increase in 1990 when the FDA lowered the recommended dosages from 1,200 milligrams a day to 600. The quality of life on AZT was universally pretty miserable. Many credible scientists argued that AZT was killing more people than AIDS. Lauritsen estimated that AZT killed 330,000 gay men between 1987 and 2019. Many of the dead were perfectly healthy before beginning the AIDS regimen. Absent AZT, Lauritsen said, the vast majority of those men would not have died. Fast Track Template. AZT's record-setting race to approval did not stand for long. By 1991, Dr. Fauci had effectively abandoned testing low-profit repurposed drugs in the Parallel Track CRI program. But he used a parallel track to open a loophole in the FDA drug approval system, a loophole large enough to drive through truckloads of pharma's new high-profit patented antivirals. Using CRI's relaxed rules, Dr. Fauci and his pharma partners shattered a series of new speed records at FDA. Still smarting from the public roasting Dr. Fauci had administered to them, bedraggled and bullied FDA officials lowered agency standards to green light Dr. Fauci's dark pharmacopoeia of deadly chemotherapy drugs with minimal safety testing. That year, exploiting the regulatory breach he had created with CRI's fast-track system, Dr. Fauci waved through another DNA chain antiretroviral terminator drug to quick approval, allowing it to skip the double-blind placebo testing he had previously declared indispensable. NIH had developed and patented didanosine before licensing it to Bristol-Myers Squibb. Didanosine won FDA approval without even a pretense of a placebo-controlled study. The drug had so many debilitating and lethal side effects that FDA, in an uncharacteristic act of civil disobedience against NIAID's diminutive dictator, issued a black box warning. Nevertheless, desperate HIV-infected Americans rushed like doomed lemmings to take the drug. In 2010, FDA issued a statement that didanosine can cause potentially a fatal liver disease called non-cirrhotic portal hypertension. Even with its demonstrated toxicity, Dr. Fauci used CRI parallel track process to bypass the usual controls to win approval for use of didanosine in pregnant mothers who test positive for HIV. A 2019 study found that didanosine accounted for 16% of prescriptions for infected mothers and 30% of the cancers in their children. In 1996, Dr. Fauci used his expedited fast track to break another record by winning FDA approval for Merck's HIV antiviral Crixivan. This time it took only 6 weeks. Dr. Fauci achieved that feat by allowing Merck to run Crixivan through a skeleton CRI process on a tiny cohort of 97 volunteers in 3 groups, thereby winning the swiftest approval in history, 42 days. That approval prompted open revolt by the AIDS community, which felt betrayed when Merck hiked up the price of the drug. Activists led by the Treatment Action Group condemned Merck's misuse of the CRI exemptions to secure approval for its deadly and ineffective drug. In 2016, Dr. Fauci boasted that his efforts had led to the approval of some